Hello, and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod, with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a delight to welcome author, historian, and the world's leading authority on the Beatles, Mark Lewison.
Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Hello, Chris.
Lovely to meet you. I've been chasing you for a while.
And I ran out of breath in the end and let you catch up.
Before we start, I guess we need to really mention Neil Innes, who died this morning on the day of we're recording this. Just really, what are your thoughts?
I love Neil Innes. I loved him for a very long time. In 1976, I was on holiday in France with a friend in a minivan, and he had the Rutland Weekend Television album on cassette. And it became the album of the trip. We played it 20, 30 times. I don't know. It was just on every day, and we played it on repeat. And I kind of missed the Rutland Weekend TV series. I'm not quite sure why, because I was a big Python fan. But that album introduced me to Neil's work, and I became a Neil Innes fan. And the following year, went to see him play at the Nashville Rooms with his band Fatso. And it was the funniest night of my life. It was hysterically funny. And that was it. I was just a great Neil Innes fan from then on, and the Ruttles followed, and the Ruttles is as close to perfection as you could ever wish. And got to know the man a little bit, met him a few times, went to loads of his gigs, bought all his albums. And latterly, I've been enjoying following him on Twitter as the voice of reason in a mad world. I almost always, no, not almost, always agreed with everything he wrote. And it's a terrible shock that he's died just today.
As you know, we did a recording with him at Abbey Road, and again, he was so graceful. He didn't have to do it. He was in the middle of his tour. I think he'd done two dates, and he said at the time his voice was shot to pieces after two because he didn't train his voice properly. He just went for it. He didn't have to do it. I mean, he spent the time to... He basically got a cab to Abbey Road. A guy called Tom arranged for us to record it at Abbey Road. And he turned up at Abbey Road before we did and said, "Oh, I'm here for Egg Pod." And they didn't know what he was talking about. So he got his cab and went back to his hotel. And then we all arrived and they said, "Oh, no, Neil, he's been and gone." We're like, "Oh, man." And he said... I phoned him up and he said, "Do you want to come and record it here at the hotel?" I was like, "We've got Abbey Road Studios here. Can you come back?" So we paid his cab fare and he did it. And he didn't complain at all. Just sat down and shared all these stories about his life.
He really was one of life's nicest people. He was witty. He was warm. He was gentle. He was a great humanitarian. He was generous. He was brilliant. He wrote wonderful songs and sang them in a great voice. And his songs, I mean, he was never, he, what did he say? When he used to perform "I'm the Urban Spaceman" in concert, he would say, "This is a medley of hits," because he only ever had the one. Yeah. I once interviewed him for Apple, actually, Apple Corps, and took along my Neil Innes record collection and had him sign all of them.
Did you?
And they were on a variety of little labels that you'd never really heard of. I mean, he was on Arista. We've heard of Arista. And Warner Brothers, I think, courtesy of Derek Taylor. But he was also on a variety of tiny labels that released one or two singles of his that sold 50 copies back in the 1980s. And as an Innes collector, I had all these things. And he was somewhat stunned that I had so many of his records and had forgotten some of them, I think, or perhaps didn't wish to remember some of them. Dear Father Christmas was one of them I remember. But it was great to have all these little drops of Neil Innes in my life through the 70s and 80s, and latterly on CD. The last album he did was is just brilliant. Just brilliant. Yeah. I like the way he matured and let us hear his maturation process as an artist. We could grow old with him, and he sang for us. And his turn of phrase, his wordplay was exquisite. Love of that girl, you takes me back and in.
This episode, we're going to be talking about the Beatles' 1962 Star Club tapes. So why did you pick this particular collection?
I think when you first asked me to come on this egg pod, I was reluctant to talk about an album.
I know.
Because I'm not a musicologist. I'm an enthusiast and a researcher and a writer, but I'm not a musicologist. And I didn't feel... I can feel comfortable with all my notes around me, writing evocatively about tracks. But to actually do that just with my voice, I was a little bit uncertain of my own ability. So,
really?
Yeah. So I fancied choosing a record, an album that has a tangible history to it. Mm. And I also realise that probably nobody else is going to choose Live at the Star Club. And yet to me, and I think hopefully I will persuade people to realise, to all of us, it is a really important Beatles album that probably never hardly ever gets mentioned.
No.
So once I realised I could do that, then I said, yes, I would come on.
Yeah. Mm. So the backstory, I'm not even going to attempt to do this, but the backstory, they'd been signed, they'd made TV appearances, radio appearances, they'd been in the studio, and now suddenly they had, was it their fifth Hamburg stint, and it was commitment that they stuck to. So,
yes.
Could they have got out of that, or did they just do it out of...
Brian Epstein signed them to two late 1962 fortnights at the Star Club back in July of 1962. And at that time, why not? Even though it was quite clear how the rest of the year they believed would pan out, because they had a recording contract with George Martin by then. Mm. When you throw dates into the diary in a distant manner, then you assume it's going to be okay when you get there. But by the time they got to November and then December... John, Paul, George and Ringo, who wasn't with them when the contract was made, didn't want to do it. They really didn't want to come back to Hamburg. The first three trips to Hamburg were all long. And these two were only going to be short, two-week little drop in and drop out. But by the time November came around, Love Me Do was in the charts and they were beginning to go places, and they were literally within Britain... getting outside of Liverpool more and more, because they had a record in the charts and because Brian was booking them into out of non-Merseyside places, they told Brian they weren't going to go in November or December. They dug their heels in and said they weren't going to go. And Brian had to cajole them into fulfilling the contract. Mm. The Beatles were pragmatic in that they would recognize that it was actually in their interest to fulfill contracts. And in fact, as far as I know, they never knowingly broke a contract. Mm. In 1963, when inevitably the hits ensured that they were playing bookings fixed at a price lower than they could command on the day they turned up, they always did turn up. Mm. Whether it was Stowe School for £100 when they had by then won and almost a second number one, they would still go. And so in the end, they reluctantly agreed, no doubt rubbing Brian's nose in it to an extent, but they reluctantly agreed that they would fulfil the agreements to go and play. But the fifth trip to Hamburg, this final one, December 62, was the one that they really did loathe. The letters home that they wrote back to England that we know of, they are complaining. George in particular complaining... Oh, yeah. About it in much the same language that he would use 4 years later or 3.5 years later when they wanted to give up touring for good.
Yeah.
We've had enough of this. We're fed up. We, you know, can't we just go home? Mm. And but they did it. And right at the very end of that final 2 week stint, at the very end of 1962, there are tapes of them on stage, recorded by a King Size Taylor, Ted King Size Taylor, leader of King Size Taylor and the Dominoes. And they're lo-fi, but we have an hour and 20, a bit more than that, of the Beatles in Hamburg, thanks to King Size Taylor.
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous gift to our knowledge of the Beatles.
The BBC Archive Twitter account showed the interview with Alan Williams and Ted Kingsize.
Yeah.
And brilliant. I'm convinced they should make that into a film with Martin Sheen as Alan Williams.
Right.
And he's saying, it's something along the lines of, he was saying about how he was pissed off with John Lennon, basically. And they said, well, what are you going to do with all the... He was saying, oh, you know, we're going to make millions, we're going to make millions. Yeah. What will you do with the money, Alan? He said, well, we'll build a statue. And he said, well, you do that for the Beatles. What, even after John Lennon, you know, you fell out with John. He says, you don't know what the statue is going to look like. It's brilliant.
I mean, Alan Williams, it's great that Alan Williams, you had nothing to do with the recording of this tape and nothing to do with the Star Club. He set the Beatles into Hamburg and he pretty much, well, no, he did get the whole Hamburg scene up and running. It was all thanks to Alan Williams, that whole breeding ground of British rock and rollers going to Hamburg, that all happened because of that one man. And yet, by the time the Beatles make it, and by the time this tape is recorded, he's not part of the scene at all. But it was great that 10 years later, when this tape was being hawked around, that he was involved again and hoping to make the money that he missed out on the first time. And in the end, didn't make the money the second time either. There's the story of the marketing of these tapes is a book in itself. And in fact, it has been chapters in books, and very entertaining they are. but yeah, I love that clip, because there's King Size Taylor, who made this tape, chopping meat in the butcher's shop in Southport, where he, I think he owned, I used to drive past his butcher's shop. Really? He's retired now. E.R. Taylor Butchers. It was on the road coming out of Liverpool to Southport. I think it's the 565. And you'll be on the right-hand side. I always look across, and there's King Size Taylor's shop.
Wow.
As Spencer Lee wrote, he swapped beet for meat. Yeah.
And the way they film it, it's just literally this.
Yes.
He doesn't look happy. He doesn't look happy.
It's, well, I mean, can you be happy chopping meat in a butcher shop? Probably you can, if you're that way disposed. But Bernard Falk did that little report for Nationwide, and Bernard Falk had been in Liverpool beat groups himself.
Cock and the Roaches.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. He was sending himself up. But, I mean, Bernie Falk, who's no longer with us, had been an early writer for Merseybeat. So he was definitely part of the scene as well. So he was the right man to do that interview. And it's an archival gem.
It is.
It's on YouTube. I was looking at it earlier.
Yeah, have a look, have a look. I think another thing in which you haven't mentioned yet, Tune In. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask that other question. But your coverage of this is so beautiful, because you tell what's going on while they're in Hamburg and also what was going back home that they may not necessarily have been aware of. But I think the one thing that you mentioned, and I'm guessing there's been a few different versions, what they did over Christmas.
Yes.
I think is the fascists.
Yes.
Involved, perhaps.
Yeah. It was the Beatles' only Hamburg trip where they were there at Christmas time. And the club was closed on the 24th. The 24th is the big Christmas holiday in parts of Europe, including Germany. And so it was closed on that day. So their final 14 days, actually, they only played 13 of them. And there are different reports on what they actually did to celebrate Christmas. There's an account of George being at the Siemens Mission, where they did a kind of British Christmas lunch. And I think it's the minister at the Siemens Mission, because there was a religious aspect to it, said that before they should say grace, and George said, "Thank God for all the food." And apparently the minister said, "If there's any more of that, you're all getting out. I'll chuck you out." But there's also an account of Paul has a reminiscence of being at a girlfriend's house for a German family Christmas, and him seeing this big, it's in my book, him seeing this big bowl of white stuff, which he assumed, I think, to be mashed potato. And he put a great dollop of it on his plate, and everyone was looking at him very strangely, and it turned out to be horseradish sauce.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to intimate or betray that he didn't realise what it was, so he ate the whole mound of horseradish sauce, which must have been awful. He always remembered that as the worst Christmas he had ever had. And then the Faschers, as you say.
Yeah, they were interesting.
Horst Fascher and his brother Freddie were both bouncers in the Star Club. Horst Fascher, in particular, being synonymous with the whole Hamburg scene. He was one of the little guys who took care of the musicians because he was a boxer. And in fact, had already been in prison for killing someone, albeit only manslaughter, which is why he was back out again. But he was a guy you wouldn't want to cross, but he was on the musician's side. He was employed to take care of the musicians and make sure that these young English guys who were obviously going to be drinking and maybe doing prellies, if they got into any trouble, that Horst would take care of them. And we hear both Horst and Freddie on these recordings.
We do.
Because they got up and sang a number each with the Beatles backing them, and we've actually now got that on tape. Great to have all this on tape. And apparently they also, how they divided themselves into so many parts, I'm not sure, but they ended up at the Faschers for Christmas lunch as well, with Mama Fascher cooking them this great feast of some kind in a cauldron in which she usually washed their underwear and shirts. It just sounds horrendous.
But probably luxury for them.
Perhaps.
Some of the tours.
Yeah. Certainly under Brian Epstein, their Hamburg trips were much better organised than they had been.
Yeah.
Alan Williams got them to Hamburg the first time. The great hero in the Beatles story is Alan Williams for doing that. Mm. But once they got there, he wasn't interested in their welfare. He just got them there.
Yes.
The following year, they got there under their own steam, so no one was looking after them at all. But once they were under Brian, he tried to ensure that they had better conditions, that they didn't play. They weren't being asked to play for 8 hours a night. They would do proper sets of like 45 minutes each. And that they stayed in a proper hotel. They stayed in their most luxurious hotel on that final trip in December 62, the Hotel Pacific. It's still there. Wow. And you can go and stay there yourself for not that much a night, but it's the best accommodation they had in the city to date.
Yeah.
And Brian wasn't there on this trip, though, so they were still pissing around on stage.
You can hear it, can't you?
Yeah, you can. There's, and that's the beauty of this,
yeah,
is that we've got, it's like an hour and a half, pretty much, of pre-fame Beatles.
Yeah.
It's the longest pre-fame recording of them that we have. It's pretty much the only good live recording of them that we have. There's The Cavern, a couple of songs from The Cavern, wonderful, but this is, you know, much, much longer. The repertoire is broad and diverse, and it's them being a club band.
Yeah, yeah.
As I say in Tune In, it's the last time they, almost the last time they would be a club band, because they would be a club band again in 1967.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that for years I didn't realise was how soon Ringo had joined the band. I mean, this was effectively a kind of warm-up gig, effectively, wasn't it, perhaps?
It's the second trip to Hamburg with Ringo in the Beatles, because he was with them in November when they went there, and now December. So he's been with them for 4 months by this point. Mm. August 18 to the end of December is 4 months. But he'd actually had his own Hamburg experiences. He'd been, there's a story in Tune In that is quite extraordinary, because Ringo had gone to Hamburg at the very end of 61. He'd left Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, and he'd gone to be in the house band at the Top Ten Club. Mm. Star Club opened in April 62. So before it did, the only club in Hamburg was the Top Ten Club. Mm. And the Star Club basically came along and trumped the Top Ten, took over its acts and took over being number one club. Mm. But Ringo was in the house band at the Top Ten Club, and he intended to stay there. And it began New Year 62. And then in mid-February, there was the most atrocious flood in Hamburg that killed over 300 people.
Wow.
And the clubs were closed for a period of time. There were power cuts, and also, it was just a horrible situation. Mm. And so Ringo left and came back to Liverpool. Arguably, had the flood not happened, he wouldn't have been available for the Beatles.
Yeah.
So he would have still been there in the Top Ten Club. Or maybe moved to the Star Club by then. But it was because of the flood that he was available for the Beatles again.
That's another one of those Beatles stories, isn't it?
Yeah, and all those people had to die for that to happen. It was over 300.
Wow.
And so he'd been in Hamburg. He'd also been in Hamburg with Rory Storm in 1960, which was when he first got to know the Beatles. But now in 62, he's with the Beatles, and this is the second time he's been there. And there's another point I make in the book, which was a realisation that since the songs we hear on this tape were not in their nightly repertoire in England anymore, we hear Ringo drumming with the Beatles on songs that they are doing with him for the first time.
Mm.
I mean, the Beatles didn't rehearse. They were playing every night. They did not rehearse. Exceptional circumstances, they might rehearse for something, but basically, they didn't rehearse.
Mm.
So they wouldn't have gone into this season in Hamburg with a rehearsal first.
No.
So when they're doing Going to Sit Right Down and Cry Over You, Nothing Shaking But the Leaves on the Trees, Wish I Could Shimmy Like My Sister Kate, it's highly unlikely that Ringo had drummed these with the Beatles before.
Wow.
And what you hear is him doing that with them for the first time, and he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. He's a great, fast drummer. His fills are superb. His timing is perfect. He binds them. He gives them everything they could possibly need. And we're hearing take one in almost every instance. It's quite amazing.
Would they have been, because there must have been a few crossover songs on Rory Storm and the Hurricanes and the Beatles, would that set list possibly have been, right, which ones do you... You know, do we both play, perhaps?
There wasn't. I don't know how much crossover there was. And Rory Storm and the Hurricanes were definitely dwindling by 1962. They were well on the downturn by then. Their peak was before the Beatles knocked them off the top. Mm. And once the Beatles knocked them off the top and kind of set the template for how groups could be, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes fell like a stone.
Mm.
And Ringo didn't only leave them to join the Beatles. He'd already left them once, as I mentioned, to come to Hamburg, but also he nearly joined Gerry and the Pacemakers at one point, Ringo.
Wow.
As bass player.
What?
As bass player.
How? What? Yeah. Tell me more.
He was going to learn the bass and join them on bass.
Brilliant.
Yeah, well, they had a drummer already, Fred Marsden, Gerry's brother. They didn't need a drummer, but he was going to join them on bass.
When was this?
61.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Why didn't it come to fruition?
I think it was probably just a pub conversation. It was one of those, I could join you on bass, and it may have seemed like a good idea for a minute or two, but no more. So it just didn't happen.
Oh, thank the Lord.
Yeah, imagine Ringo on bass and Gerry and the Pacemakers.
Yeah.
So Ringo absolutely deserved to be a Beatle, but the turns of fate and the alternate journeys that he might have taken before he became a Beatle that might have prevented him ever becoming a Beatle are interesting to see.
Beatles are in Hamburg. What's going on back in England?
What's going on back in England is that Love Me Do is still climbing the charts. Love Me Do came out on October 5. It made, that's a Friday. The record retailer Top 50 was computed on sales up to the Saturday. And typically, actually, that would mostly mean Saturday morning because a lot of shops used to close half day on a Saturday in those days. And it sold enough copies in Liverpool to sneak into the national chart at number 49. So it made the chart on its very first weekend. And at that time, people, those who followed the business, and it was a small business really, were saying, well, that's just, well, some people thought Brian bought the record in, that he had actually fabricated its position, which he hadn't. But also, well, they're popular in their own neck of the woods. But what happened was after that, it began in a slow but steady way to take a national hold. Every time Love Me Do got played, more people bought it. And it did get onto radio. It was on the BBC, on the Light programme. It was on Radio Luxembourg. And then they did it on television. Did it on Granada. And they did it on a London programme that most of Britain saw in December 62. And every time it was played, it picked up sales, and so it hung around on the charts. And eventually, more than 2 months after release, in fact, nearly three, it peaked at number 17 while the Beatles were in Hamburg on this final trip. So it's a remarkable thing. They were annoyed that they were having to go to Hamburg because they believed that without them being in Britain to support the record, it would fall, it would go down. But remarkably, on both of the last two trips to Hamburg, It climbed the charts while they were away because it was being played in their absence.
Yeah.
So that was happening. Another thing that was happening was that the music publisher Dick James, who was hugely excited by Please Please Me and Ask Me Why, knew, as did George Martin, that when it came out in January, it had a strong chance of being a number one record because it was that exciting and that good.
Yeah.
And Dick James perceptively thought, well, John and Paul's last two songs were published by Ardmore and Beechwood, and then they left them. These two songs are being published with my company, Dick James Music, but they could leave me. And he wanted to tie them down in some way that was appealing to them. And already in late 62, ahead of the release of Please Please Me, he and Brian Epstein are discussing the formation of a music publishing company exclusively for Lennon and McCartney, or McCartney-Lennon songs. So that was the initial contract for that was being drafted whilst the Beatles were in Hamburg. How much John and Paul knew about that, I'm not sure. They were under no obligation to agree to it. But I imagine it was something that Brian told them as soon as they got back. So that was happening. And extraordinarily, the Beatles were being turned down by American record companies whilst they're in Hamburg on this final time. They were turned down by Lorry Records, they were turned down by Liberty Records, they were certainly turned down by Capitol Records, and they were about to be turned down by Atlantic Records, which is mind-boggling. And all these things were happening in the last days of December 1962. But they were pretty much unaware of all of that. They would have been told who was signing them, not who was rejecting them. But as I wrote in Tune In, the year of 1962 began with Decca turning down the Beatles on the basis of a bit of a substandard test that they gave on New Year's Day, 62.
Yeah.
But these American record companies are turning them down on the basis of Please Please Me. That's a wholly different thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, those rejections are, they deserve better scrutiny than the Decca situation almost. But they ended up being signed by VJ Records at the beginning of January. Mm. And
who certainly got their money's worth with those songs.
Well,
how many different versions?
Well, I mean, they only had a certain number of tracks, but they did as much as they could with them while they could. In the end, by the end of 64, they'd all been taken away from them. Mm. But, you know, you can't blame them for doing what they did with them. And they did release the Beatles faithfully. They released Please Please Me and From Me to You. And From Me to You kind of did something, but not a lot. But it did something in America. Love me do.
I love when you were saying about the people and places. Again, some footage recently turned up, some audio turned up.
Yes, audio, yeah.
And it's weird. You think they've recorded it, and then Ringo veers into the Pete Best, the one on the anthology where Pete Best kind of speeds up during the harmonica solo.
Yes.
Ringo does that, and they've already recorded the version that we know.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, would he have learnt that from Pete?
No, Pete did that. That little skip in the middle of Love Me Do. He did that because that was how they arranged it when they were reviving the song. Love Me Do was an old song from 58. And it was in May 62 when they got their EMI contract that they decided to rework it and record it in their first session. And that was actually part of the arrangement that John and Paul came up with. So although Pete gets a lot of flack for that bit of drumming in Love Me Do, really what he was trying to achieve, he didn't achieve it particularly well, but what he was trying to achieve was this rather duff idea that they would speed up there. And I do write that in Tune In. And for what is really strange is that on this newly available recording, we hear Ringo doing it even after, as you say, the record has come out without it. So they must have still thought that it had some currency.
Or did he just forget? Possibly.
I don't know that he ever heard the June recording. I would imagine he never had.
No.
I can't think how he would have heard it. I think it's much more likely that they told him what they wanted, as much as they had told Pete what they wanted.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Mm.
Weird to hear that.
But good.
Yeah. Great that these recordings are now surfacing.
Yeah. There's so much surfacing. Do you find stuff, you know, in the volume one of Tune In, there's stuff since emerged, you think, oh man, that could have gone in, or...
Yeah. Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, history doesn't stop just because you've written a book, does it? I mean, it carries on. Things still surface, and in a sense, the book Tune In actually is a trigger for more things to happen, because people read it and go, oh, I've got this. Oh, I wish I'd had that before I wrote the book, or before I finished the book. And you think, well, if I hadn't finished the book, I wouldn't be seeing it now anyway, because the guy's only got in touch with me because he's read the book. So, yeah, that's inevitable. But it's okay. I will eventually fold these things into some kind of a revised update, but not until all three books are out. I'm not going to dicker with the... I'm not going to start doing revisions of the first book before I've done the second or the third.
No.
Yeah.
I did something a couple of years ago where, just for the crack, really, but I wanted to find all the source photos on the Pepper cover and find out the original photos that they cut out from.
Right.
I've still got about three. This was 2 years ago. I've got three I could never find.
Yes.
Which I think are in a private collection. Don't know.
Which are the three?
Oh,
can you remember?
Gosh.
I know we're veering off topic wildly.
I'm going to have to Google it. Terry Southern.
Right.
His son actually got in touch with me as well and said, not sure. There's the artist Richard Lindner.
Yes.
And the artist Wallace Berman.
Right.
And again, I think it's Josh Berman. His son got in touch with me as well. He couldn't find them.
Right.
And yeah, I've looked possibly. I think they were personal friends of Michael Cooper. And I think that they were.
Southern was, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Southern and Michael Cooper knew each other because I think they were beginning to work on Clockwork Orange at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if anybody out there knows, let me know.
Yeah.
Any help, greatly appreciated.
Yes, I'll see what I've got in my files. I know we were in touch with each other at the time, weren't we, when you were putting that all together.
Yeah.
But I might have something.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But my point being, that took me 2 years just for that one little project.
Yeah.
And my filing system's not great. You must be really good at admin. Because how do you... Because you've recently moved.
Yeah.
And you've basically got a place where you're going to store... everything.
Yeah.
How do you file?
Yeah.
Is it chronologically, alphabetically?
No. I am good at admin, and I'm an organized person with a pretty tidy mind and a logical mind, good at logistics.
Mm.
So all of which are skills that are necessary when you're researching and writing a project like this. But the sheer volume of what I have is almost defies organization.
Mm.
So although I used to pride myself on always knowing where everything was, in latter periods of time, I've kind of lost control of it.
Mm.
And it's just like I've just got tons of stuff in piles and I haven't got time to organize it. I often say this, but when I was helping with the Beatles anthology 25 years ago, there was a team of people on that. Thinking offhand, I would imagine there must have been about 12 to 15 people in the production office, and more in the head office as well. And this project is similar to that, and I'm on my own.
Mm.
So it's as soon as you focus on one thing, you look to the right, and while you're doing that, to the left, something's piling up, and I have kind of lost control of it. And now in my new headquarters, I'm intending to get a better sense of it all. Mm. And I'm going to need some librarians' help, really, in getting it into shape so that I can use it. Because the whole point of gathering stuff is really to be able to use it, not merely to point to it and say, look at what I've got. I mean, it's a working archive for a writer. It's a library.
Absolutely.
And So though I am organized, it's really tough on a project like this.
Mm. I can't even fathom.
Yeah. Yeah. And volume two of the trilogy is in scope and content and depth and breadth of information about five times what Tune In was.
I can imagine.
And I'm older than I was when I did Tune In. And it's a challenge. It's a major challenge. Serious challenge.
I'm going to bring some vitamins next time for you.
So when's it coming out, Mark?
No, I didn't ask that.
No, but everybody else does. And I ask myself that question as well. Believe me, I don't need other people to ask
it. When it's ready, surely.
When it's ready, but time is of the essence.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there.
Leave it there.
So many songs here that we don't really hear again, even on BBC sessions, but the only two McCartney-Lennon, I saw her standing there and...
Ask Me Why.
Ask Me Why.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Yes.
Why were they not performing P.S. I Love You, Love Me Do? Is there any reason why they wouldn't have played those?
Very good question. I don't know the answer to that. There's no Love Me Do, there's no P.S. I Love You, there's no Please Please Me, there's no One After 909, there's no Tip of My Tongue, there's no World Without Love, you know, I'll Follow the Sun, all the other songs that they kind of had up their sleeves by this point.
Mm.
It's important to stress that these are long fragments of recordings. I think it's now established that there are five, the tapes that we have are from five different recordings. Initially, when these tapes were marketed in 1977, the suggestion was it was one night, probably New Year's Eve, and that, you know, they were on stage and this is for 2 hours and this is the whole thing. But it's now been established by people who look into all this forensically that there's about five different recordings on here. So, and none of those is that long.
Mm.
None of those would have been the length of any one set. So it could well be that they were doing those songs and they're just simply not on the tapes, which were quite clearly being switched off and switched on, the tape recorder. In Tune In, I also looked at... it's always interesting to look at Beatles things in abstract. And I looked at the songs that we don't have on this Star Club recording, that we absolute, they were the staple backbone of their live set in 1962. For example, there's no Some Other Guy.
Mm, yeah.
There's no Soldier of Love.
Yeah.
There's no Please Mr. Postman. Don't Ever Change.
Mm.
I'm reading my list here. Shot of Rhythm and Blues, Devil in Her Heart, Baby It's You, Will You Love Me Tomorrow? All these were big parts of their repertoire in 62.
Yeah.
If You Gotta Make a Fool of Somebody, Hey Baby, Picture of You, Lucille, Slow Down, Sharing You, Sure to Fall, Young Blood, Money, Anna, Chains, and Keep Your Hands Off My Baby, which crept into their set right at the end of the year, but still not on these tapes. So it could be that they were doing those songs and we just don't have recordings of them. But it could just be that such was the extent of their repertoire that they could afford to leave all these songs out and yet still give us 37 numbers. Yeah. It's a bit of duplication, but basically 37 numbers are available now, or 37 recordings. I think there's about four duplications, so something like 33 different pieces. Without them doing any of those things, I mean, wouldn't it be great to have them doing Some Other Guy or Soldier of Love, or Devil in Her Heart or A Shot of Rhythm and Blues? But no, instead we get them doing Little Queenie, Falling in Love Again.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
Well, how did that get, I'm assuming Paul, but
Paul,
I'm wondering, was there any sort of relevance to their lives with that particular song?
Now, I think I'm right in saying, checking my own notes here, Falling in Love Again, didn't that come to them? No, it was Marlene Dietrich, of course. I was thinking somebody had done it, like they used to do Over the Rainbow, but it wasn't really because of Wizard of Oz, it was because Gene Vincent did it.
Okay.
And I was thinking, did anybody do Falling in Love Again that might have influenced them? But no, I think it was Marlene Dietrich.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're in Germany, so Marlene Dietrich is controversially current still. The interesting thing about Falling in Love Again is that Paul wrote a lyric for it.
Really?
Because it was in German. It wasn't in English.
Okay.
There may have been, I suspect there must have been, some kind of English adaptation. But the lyric that we hear Paul sing Falling in Love Again on the Star Club tapes is his lyric.
Wowzers.
Yeah. So really it's, who wrote it? Was it Hollander? So it really should be Hollander McCartney.
Wow.
But I don't think it went down that way.
No.
But it could be, because it's his lyric. Yeah. Falling in love again, more and more each day. Can't you hear me say, I adore you?
Yeah.
Which is a strange line, first line, final line of the first verse, because it's got one too many syllables in it.
Mm.
Why didn't he say, I love you? Yeah. Which would be right, instead of adore, which kind of doesn't fit.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, and there's six verses there. And he wrote those.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is the only recording we have of it.
Yeah. Go and buy this record, people.
Yes. Yeah.
One of my highlights on this is Red Hot.
Yeah.
There's been a few bootlegs doing the rounds. There was one called Starry Nights.
Yes.
And which I thought, you've just informed me that that's already been usurped. I thought that was the best quality and the best we've got the full version of Red Hot, but you've corrected me.
Yeah, on that. Starry Night was the go-to best set when I wrote Tune In, but it has now been bettered by some other set that's circulating unofficially. And it has a longer version of Red Hot than we'd ever had before. Red Hot wasn't on the 1977 releases. Mm. I first heard Red Hot on a bootleg called The Beatles versus Don Ho.
Wow. Yes.
Which I think I got in about 1980, in appropriately enough, in Holland, in the Netherlands, the home of bootlegs.
Yeah.
And I had no idea who Don Ho was. It turns out to be some, I think, Hawaiian-born entertainer known in America. Totally irrelevant. But there was this snatch of Red Hot, which had been broadcast on American radio, but it was incomplete, and that was all we had.
Yeah.
But now it's been artificially extended to be more complete. So although it's a bit of a fake and a fix, it does give us the opportunity to hear it as it would have been.
Yeah.
And it's just been kind of cleverly looped in some way by somebody on their computer to make it a more presentable recording. It doesn't just end abruptly.
Yeah.
It actually somehow has a completeness to it, which is good. I mean, I prefer to have the whole thing real, but at least we can now hear more of it and something like it would have been in the club. And that's a great one because John and George sing that lead together. Yeah. And there weren't many songs that John and George sang lead together. John and Paul singing lead together, yes, but not John and George.
Mm.
So it's a good one for that.
Great vocals they are.
And it's super fast.
Yeah.
It's really fast. I think Ronnie Hawkins did the version that has inspired them. And God, they knew some records, those guys.
I know.
They really did know some records.
Yeah. I think you mentioned it earlier, but Prelly's, I think, particularly on that song, could be prevalent.
Yes.
Prevalent.
Yeah, probably. I mean, John, we need to talk about John Lennon on this recording, well, these recordings, because he's belligerent. He's under the influence of, I'm sure he's under the influence of Prelly's, probably drink as well. He's beguiling, he's rude, he's still charming. He's not horrible. He's just edgy.
Could he, because there's one before I Wish I Could Shimmy Like My Sister Kate where he shouts and I'm guessing the fascists, they were there to protect. They must have known what he was like. Was that the reason they were there?
Well, the fascists, I mean, this is Clubland we're talking about.
Yeah.
So Clubland always have heavies around. And but, you know, John, these English musicians were not just the Beatles. They were all drinking and a lot of them were taking pills and they were all young guys away from home, let loose. And there was a lot of misbehaviour, and the guys, the fascists, were there to kind of keep control of the Beatles and others, and make sure they didn't get into any trouble. But also, they were aware of how provocative the acts could be.
Mm.
You know, John calling someone a kraut bastard from the stage, kraut bastard. But you can hear they're being heckled as well.
Yes, it's the same guy, I think.
Yeah, there's some guy who keeps shouting in German, too loud.
Yeah.
And
shut up!
And they're just shouting back, shut up!
Yeah.
That interaction, that audience interaction is just brilliant to hear. It's real. This tape is real, and they're not performing for the tape. Mm. Sometimes when artists know they're being recorded, they're watchful of what they're doing. But this is simply a little, either a Grundig or a Philips tape recorder off to on a little table by the side of the stage with a microphone dangling over their heads that they're kind of oblivious to. They may know it's recording, but they don't care. It's recording anyway. Mm. All the acts are being recorded, not just the Beatles.
Yes, yeah.
And yeah. And so they're performing, then they're not filtering themselves in any way. And that's part of the strength of this tape, is that you get to eavesdrop, literally like the microphone hanging over the stage. We can hang over the stage as listeners and just kind of hear what's going on in the club this night.
June called Red Sails at the Sunset. The one you've come for. Thanks, Grafina. Bontina. Ah! Bettina!
And we get to meet, or we get to hear her name, Bettina.
Bettina!
I just want to read a bit from Tune In. This is just, I love this. Here is John's ubiquitous Edinburgh accent and in his lecherous macho bay for Bettina. She's felt, but not heard. Paul dedicates Your Feet's Too Big to her, at which she'd have knifed the foam from a beer, nodded her beehived blonde mane, jiggled her vast bust, and set the bar lantern swinging. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. That is perfect.
Yeah.
You're there.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
But it's...
Big Betty, with whom John had some kind of a fling. Mm. They definitely had something going on between them, those two.
Yeah.
And there's a bit in Tune In where I quote Tony Sheridan, now no longer with us, saying that when people were observing John and Bettina together in Hamburg, the common sentiment was, what's he doing with her?
Really?
And that is exactly the same thing that they would be saying in 68 and 69 when he was with Yoko. What's he doing with her?
Yeah.
But, you know, John didn't do the obvious.
Mm.
And he was drawn to interesting women. And Bettina was one.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bettina.
I love Bettina.
Just brilliant to have that on tape.
Yeah.
You know, there's about 1,000 gems packed into this Star Club tape.
Yeah.
Little moments like that.
You think how they presented just a few months later to the general public as clean cuts. And this, you know, if this had been released at the time,
yeah,
it was off.
Well, I would argue that they were presented as clean cut. I don't buy that one. That's what everybody says, but I don't buy that. I don't buy that. And that's, I'll be looking at this in much greater depth in volume two.
So when's that?
I think they were only ever themselves, but I think people projected onto them.
Okay.
If you hear them speak in 63, they were always speaking their mind. Mm. They were never, they were filtering a tiny degree, I suppose. They weren't being offensive. Although they did have their moments. But no, I think that they were well brought up lads who knew how to behave. But essentially, they were always themselves. Mm. And there wasn't the call for them to be doing long between songs interruptions or announcements. As they would always do a little bit of that. Paul's doing it on this tape as well. But essentially, I think they were always themselves. Mm. This clean-cut business needs looking at.
Yeah, interesting.
As does the whole mop tops thing. I don't buy into that either. Ooh. I think they were always just themselves.
Mm. Speaking to all these people, I mean, you must have met everybody. How do you deal with not having access to the key people, perhaps, that you'd want?
Well, I have had access. Mm. I don't have it now, but I have had access, so I'm not short of access. And also, what is it I'd be getting now? Now, I mean, Ringo's 80 in the year we're about to enter, 2020, and Paul is going to be 78. Look, I'm not saying I wouldn't take the offer if it came to me. Of course I would. There are things I could usefully ask them and do my best to jog their memory to help them remember. And I would like that to happen, but I can cope pretty well without it. Mm. So I'm not bereft and I'm not lacking material, as I said earlier. Mm. So it's a pity, and as I often say when this question comes up, this is a very long project I'm doing. I think from the time I began it in 2003 to the time I finish it is going to be 30 years or whatever, in the ballpark of 30 years, and things change in that time. You can be in favour and then come out, and you can be out of favour and then come in. And, you know, I've only got one of the three out so far, so anything can change from now on.
Mm, let's hope so.
Yeah. There were birds in the sky, all right. major highlight for me is Till There Was You.
Right.
What we know of Till There Was You is that it was one of those songs that Paul heard. I think he heard Peggy Lee's recording. His cousin, Bette Robbins, turned him on to Peggy Lee's recording of Till There Was You. Paul recognised that it was a great song and it was one he would enjoy singing. And he introduced it into the Beatles act. And the Beatles were always content to do a diverse array of music. When we hear all their studio albums, we hear their diversity. You know, you not only have John singing and Paul singing and George singing and Ringo singing, but the styles of songs that they do vary from track to track. When you listen to an album by an artist now, like the Billie Eilish album that I've been listening to, as much as I like what she's doing, after about four tracks of it, you've kind of heard it.
Mm.
And you wouldn't want to hear that many in one sitting, at least I wouldn't. Not because they're not good, but because they end up sounding a bit similar. And that's an accusation that could never be held against the Beatles. Their albums are diverse. And similarly, as a stage act, they were diverse.
Mm.
And Till There Was You was a valid part of their act, but John didn't enjoy it. He did it. He could have completely vetoed it, but didn't.
Mm.
But in the recording on the Star Club tapes, which, as I said, was not knowingly recorded, it was just kind of we're eavesdropping on them in a club, you hear that he is echoing Paul while Paul is singing it.
Yeah.
So where Paul sings, "No, I never heard them at all," and John is going, "No, he never heard them."
Yeah.
And that is happening all the way through the song. He's taking the piss out of Paul while Paul is singing. And as I wrote in Tune In, what a brilliant little eavesdrop that is on their chemistry, their mutual chemistry. Paul would not have accepted that from anybody else on the planet than John Lennon. And he can't stop John doing it, and he quite likes John doing it because it's John, and he loves John, and this is John's humour, and their sense of, they were so together on humour that he would have enjoyed it. He's not derailed by it. He sees it through, but he can't stop it either. So if he wanted John to stop, John wasn't going to stop. And it's just part of their double act. It's part of their chemistry. What a brilliant little couple of minutes that is. If you want to understand John Lennon and Paul McCartney, that is a gift to the understanding of these guys. It's not all you need to know, but it's a key part of who they are as a duo.
Mm.
And, of course, John and Paul are core of the Beatles because John started it and he brought in Paul. So Paul is John's choice.
Mm.
George is Paul's choice and Ringo is George's choice. But Paul is John's choice.
Mm.
And they've been together since 57. They've now been together for 5.5 years almost. Mm. And they know each other. They know each other very well. They've had their trip to Paris in 61 that was a turning point in the success of the Beatles. And here they are on stage in Hamburg for pretty much the last time. And you just get to hear that. And I've been listening to this album on and off for about, when it came out in 77, so 35 years before I heard that in Till There Was You, before I heard it. I'd played it many times and not noticed it. And then I suddenly noticed it and I said, wow, that is brilliant.
Yeah,
that is completely brilliant. John taking the piss out of Paul while he's singing, but in a charming way.
Yes,
you know, knowing
Paul seems to he's giggling, isn't he?
Yeah. There's another point. I can't remember what song it is. Where again, it's one of those songs where Paul is singing, kind of sweetly ballady. We can picture Paul. We don't have images to go with this tape, but Paul is looking above the audience in that way that he did, where he would look slightly up to the ceiling in the distance, that look that he put on his face when he sang like that. And he's singing something sensitive, and suddenly John shouts out, "Shut up talking!"
It's a taste of honey.
A taste of honey.
Yeah.
Right. And whoever was talking in it, first of all, it's a club, so people do talk in clubs, right? But secondly, it's done just to derail Paul. And Paul, you hear Paul laugh at that.
Yeah.
And no matter how loudly someone might have been talking in the audience, it wasn't half as loud as John shouting out, "Shut up talking."
Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
Interesting, the beginning of that as well, Paul, because I think there's a couple of versions on here, but
yeah.
On one of them,
yeah.
Paul introduces and says it's a song that George is going to hate.
Right.
And you hear George in the background, no, I love it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, yeah, you can see the dynamics of John's in charge, then Paul, you know, then George is third or whatever.
Yes.
But, John... It's just a joy on this, isn't
he? Yeah, you wouldn't necessarily want to be singled out by him if you're in the audience, because, you know, belligerent is the word.
Yeah.
But we need to hear that, because we know these stories of John, and now we get the chance to hear it. But he's still charming with it as well, you know. What does he say? There's something like, I don't know if you can hear me or not, but piss off.
Yeah.
There weren't many acts on stage, even in Hamburg, in 1962, who will be swearing at the audience.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know if you can understand me at all, being foreign and all.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's those moments.
They were themselves. They were always who they were. Mm. And they'd been doing this in Liverpool as well. And, you know, it wasn't just in Hamburg, but Hamburg was a place where they were kind of off the leash because they were in a foreign country, and they felt they had some license to not only misbehave, but also to say things on stage and that most people would not understand. Mm. I mean, in those days, few probably know, I stand to be corrected on this if I'm wrong, but I don't think German school children were yet learning English. I don't think they were. So there wouldn't have been many people there who actually understood what they were saying.
No.
So that gives them the license to say, to be more outrageous.
Things I picked up on this as well is how many George songs are there.
Yeah.
So from George's perspective, they've just been signed and he's doing all these songs during out of necessity, I guess, for the time. But I'm wondering how you then felt, you know, you're only going to get one song on the album, and then, you know, would that have impacted his confidence at all? Because there's about a dozen songs on here, I think, or maybe not that many. But.
Well, in Tune In, I gathered every available set list of the Beatles in 1962, in fact, any time. But in 62, there are quite a few set lists around. And when I analysed them, a pattern became clear that from about the time when Brian Epstein became the Beatles manager at the end of 61, start of 62, if you went to see the Beatles in Liverpool or anywhere, they would do songs in rotation on stage. John, Paul, George, John, Paul, George, John, Paul, George. He had an equal number of songs on stage as John and Paul. And that extended into 63 as well. And only really altered when, with the pressure of fame and the nature of their live appearances changing, because once they went into theatres, then they were doing shorter sets because that was the business in those days. Then he was, his contribution was decimated, because they would pretty much have to do the records that people knew. You know, when we're Please Please Me was number one, they would have to do Please Please Me. When From Me to You was number one, they would do From Me to You. They would do Ask Me Why. They would do Thank You Girl. They would do I Saw Her Standing There, and so on. And suddenly, because John and Paul were writing the songs that the public knew, and they would naturally be doing those songs in their live appearances, George's contribution on stage was cut, and it never came back. But until that time, he had been getting an equal share of stage time with John and Paul, and that's what you hear on this tape.
And again, John, again, I think it's that hospital radio interview where they're saying, who's the leader of the band? And Paul says, John, effectively. So for John to have the grace to allow George equal time at that particular time. It seems bizarre to me.
Well, John Lennon's leadership of the Beatles from, I mean, we need to consider, first of all, when we think of the Beatles, when most people think of the Beatles, they think of this thing, this act, this kind of legends or whatever. But really, we're just talking about guys in a band. And guys in a band have their own, like guys in any sphere of life, like any, like men, women in groups of friends or whatever it might be, school, whether it's in the school playground or whatever, a dynamic will take shape. And the dynamic in the Beatles was set by John because it was his band. And his idea was to have complete democracy at all times. So when he brings Paul in, it's noticeable, the famous picture of them, the first picture of them together on stage at New Clubmore Hall in late 1957. It's the Quarrymen. They've been together about a year. The other guys are the guys in the back. And Paul is side by side with John.
Yeah.
Two microphones at the front, John at one, Paul at the other. They are side by side, shoulder to shoulder. John has put Paul there. Come in, don't just join the group and kind of stand over there, but come and stand next to me and we'll do this thing together, is essentially what that picture tells us. And that is the way that John Lennon led the Beatles. Everybody had an equal say. Everything was equally divided. The myth was that Ringo was on a salary for a while. No, as soon as they brought Ringo in, and they were on really good money by this point, through their own hard work, they give him an equal one quarter. And when Paul brings in George, yes, we know that he was much younger than John, but still John did have him there. It was a big age gap, 2.5 years. And when Brian suggests to them that George should be getting equal stage time, yes, John accepts that. That was the way he led the Beatles. And again, this tape gives us the opportunity to hear it, because it's soon going to disappear. And then George becomes, in his own words, Beatles second class.
Yes.
And that's because of Lennon McCartney. Lennon McCartney is the core of the Beatles, really, because they, you know, they wrote the songs that got them the fame and money. But it got John and Paul a lot more money than it got George and Ringo. There was a huge wealth disparity in the Beatles. Huge.
From what you were saying as well, on your Hornsey Road tour, the tape, or the tape that you talked about. That continued, didn't it, that democracy, the fact that they recorded it at all, so Ringo could hear it. That continued throughout the whole, albeit with different dynamics and hierarchies, perhaps.
But they always had an equal say. The big change in 1969, which I looked at in the show that I did, in the theatre show, was when John, George and Ringo wanted Alan Klein and Paul didn't. And they really did have to appoint somebody, and he was the obvious contender, and three of them liked him. So for the first time, they broke their unanimity policy, and that was the big moment that hastened the breakup. Nonetheless, in all other forms and all other decisions, it was still had to be 4-0 before anything went through. And that meeting... That meeting is another incredibly interesting tape, because not only is the content interesting, but we hear how John is still running things, because the implication of all the books, and indeed from John's own words, was that when is that Paul kind of took over when Brian died. Mm. And though that was true, he knew what he meant by that. But here is a crucial meeting about the future of the Beatles from September 1969, and John is running it. Mm. And Paul is conspicuously quiet in it.
Oh, man, one of the worst days of my life. I just got back from holiday and I got an email from you saying you were going to do a preview of the talks.
Right.
I think you did two dates, neither of which I did
two. Little rehearsals, yeah.
And I'm guessing you played a lot more of the tape.
Yeah.
Than we actually got to hear. So what happened between then and when you performed?
Yes. So what actually happened was I was given about 4.5, nearly 5 minutes of this meeting tape. It actually runs about 50 minutes, apparently. And I'm, as you can imagine, desperate to hear the rest of it. And I hope that by the time I get to write about it, which will be volume 3, I will have heard it all by then. So far, I've only heard a bit that circulates amongst a small group of people. I'm not the only one who's got it. And I certainly don't own it, but I have a recording of it. So I have this tape, and I was intent on playing bits of it in my touring show, Hornsey Road, because it's so fascinating in terms of the content, what they're actually saying to each other in this meeting. And I played it to the journalist Richard Williams, the ex-Melody Maker journalist, now writes for The Guardian, who came to my house to do an interview with me to promote the tour, or at least to highlight the fact that the tour would be happening. Mm. And I played it to him, and I actually hadn't realised it at the time, being somewhat naive, I suppose. But as the journalist, he obviously realised that's the focus of his piece. Yes, I'm going to be doing a tour, and that's interesting, but really it was the tape that was of particular interest. So he made that the basis of his article in The Guardian. And this being the 21st century, just flew around the world in about 5 minutes, courtesy of the internet. And suddenly everyone's talking about it. And that brought me and that tape to the attention of Apple Corps.
Mm.
And I then did my two open rehearsals that you were invited to and couldn't come, and played it because I was routining the show.
Mm.
And but on the very eve of the opening date of the tour, I heard from Apple with a very strong suggestion that I do not play it.
Really?
And I took advice, and I realized I had to row back a bit.
Really?
Because I wanted the tour to go ahead. I didn't want it to be stopped, and people had bought tickets by this point, and I took the pragmatic view. So legal advice indicated I was able to play a section of it, which I did every night, and to paraphrase the bits that I wasn't going to be actually playing.
Mm.
So I did. The audiences did still get to hear a bit of it, and I did get to say, paraphrase the bits that I couldn't play.
Mm.
So it pretty much did get out there. I just couldn't use it as I was hoping to.
Yeah. Mm. I think there were a few of us there at the time, the first thing we said, Apple. The moment you said that.
Yeah, the thing is, it had never been released. And it was technically, since John Lennon made the recording, it's owned by Yoko. I would have had to have cleared it with her. I wasn't going to try and do that with one day to go.
No.
I mean, maybe I should have tried earlier, but I had a feeling that, I wouldn't be allowed to do it at all. Mm. And the other thing is that of the three Beatles we hear on it, Paul is still alive, and I would have to clear it with him.
Mm.
Because it was a recording of his voice.
Mm.
So, I just took the legal advice and just dropped most of it, but did still play a bit.
Well, I think the Guardian article, I read that, and I think he described Paul's voice as being a bit dozy, I think was the term he used.
I think Richard felt that Paul was probably probably had a jazz cigarette, which, right. I mean, they were all still smoking a fair bit of pot in those days. Yeah. And pot, not a word that people use much these days, but that's what it was. And Richard, as soon as he heard it, he said, "Oh, Paul's had a smoke." And maybe he had, but you know, you can't tell for sure. Paul is amazingly quiet on this tape, though, except for that devastating moment when he tells George that he didn't rate any of his songs before Something and Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah.
Which is quite extraordinary. Every night when I paraphrased that on stage in the tour, there was a gasp from the audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he could have worded it more sensitively, you might say, but these guys have known each other a long time.
Yeah.
George and Paul go back to about 54, and this is 15 years by 1969, and they had been through everything together. They'd been through wars together, or so it must have felt, and I think they had developed a shorthand way of speaking frankly to one another that kind of removed the niceties of the language because they weren't necessary. Mm. These guys were famously free of bullshit, and that appears to be the way that they related to one another.
Mm.
So Paul just spoke his mind.
Yeah.
And George, to his enormous credit, didn't punch him on the nose, and just took a pragmatic view of Paul's remark.
Mm. Yeah.
One imagines it must have been hurtful, but there's also every possibility that it wasn't the first time he'd ever heard such a thing.
Mm. And again, going back to that Star Club tape where Paul's saying, "Oh, George is going to hate this one."
Yeah.
You know, he's on stage introducing a song that he's basically telling the audience one of the band members hates this song.
Yes.
And, how tight they were.
They were frank. They always spoke their mind, which is why I don't subscribe to this mop top presenting themselves, you know, as happy-go-lucky lads. I think that's kind of just how they came across, but I think they were always being strong.
Yeah.
I think I can back that up as well in Volume 2.
Ooh, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talking of Volume 2, I've got to ask this, which will be covering 1967, I'm guessing.
No.
It won't be?
No, 66.
Interesting, okay.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's 4 years.
Wow.
63, 4, 5, 6.
Okay. Moving back to 1967.
Yes, Volume 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I won't ask about that one. Carnival of Lights.
Yes.
You're one of the few people to have heard it.
Yeah.
And I know in the recording sessions you give us a guideline of what it sounds like.
Yes.
And I think there's also the book by Barry Miles.
Yes, Barry Miles. Barry Miles heard it before he wrote Many Years From Now.
Yeah. Can you tell us any more?
No, I can't. I wrote the recording sessions book 33 years ago almost. So, no. I know that if you go on YouTube, I was having this conversation with someone just the other day because he said, "You can now hear it, it's on YouTube." And I said, "No, you can't." "But it's on YouTube." "No, it isn't." But if you go to YouTube, there is a recording on there, maybe even more than one, that purports to be Carnival of Light. And it's basically very creatively put together by someone based on the available knowledge. A new recording has been made intimating it's the Beatles one, but it isn't.
No,
all I ever say about it is that the fascination for it will probably evaporate once people hear it. And I'm sure that's true. But, you know, I do still hope it comes out. I hope everything comes out.
Well, you said this recently.
Yeah.
Enough time has passed.
Yes.
There's no reason, really, with the formats that we've now got available. You know, they know fans will pay whatever for box sets.
Yeah.
To release everything, they would get their money.
I think ultimately everything has to come out. That's my feeling anyway. And I don't just mean every recording, but every bit of TV and film and every document and every scrap. My archive, when eventually I'm done with it or life has done with me, will be available for scrutiny, for study by anyone who wants to see, you know, read or write their own book based on what I've got. And everything's should be available, in my opinion. And I've ceased to worry about what label things are on. So when you said earlier, could we talk about bootlegs? Yeah, what the hell? I mean, does it matter what label things are on? It's the content that counts. Yes. You know, since people very seldom now look at labels anyway, I mean, when you bought a Beatle record in the 60s, it had that great pound sign on it, and it would say Parlophone or Capitol or Odeon, depending on what country you were in. But now we mostly hear our music electronically as a file, and you don't even see a label.
No.
And does it really matter whether it's official or unofficial? I mean, as an author, I would hate my books. My books are pirated, and I lose money as a result of that, and there's nothing I can do about it. So I understand the frustration of creative people, because I'm one myself, at lost revenue. But at the end of the day, the Beatles are a major part of the history of the modern world. And the more we know about them, the more we can appreciate them. And whether the Star Club tapes are on Lingersong or The Click of a Mouse, or even if they were to release it themselves, Apple, kind of is irrelevant now. It's the content that counts.
Are you aware you've been bootlegged? The horns, I've had some MP3s offered.
Yeah.
For free. I don't think people are charging for it. But
no.
Yeah, you're circulating
the... Yes, I think a couple of the shows were bootlegged. I'm aware of yes, someone even showed me the artwork for a CD.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. you can't avoid these things, can you? Once you do something in public, and everyone has a recording device on them these days, and of course it's going to happen. We tried, on behalf of Apple and Universal and all of that, and also myself, I tried to ensure that no one recorded it. You know, ushers were asked to watch out for people filming, but if someone's recording, it's going to happen. Speaking of Apple, Apple now own the Star Club tape. When this was recorded in 1962, it was just done on an amateur basis by Ted Taylor. And they were already at that point under contract to EMI. So technically speaking, music recordings of the Beatles would belong to EMI.
Right.
So the way around that in 1977... when this was first issued as an album, was to say that it was recorded before they signed to EMI, and yet by luck, Ringo is on drums. Now, it turns out that the only time Ringo was in Hamburg with the Beatles prior to him joining them was in late 1960 at the Kaiserkeller, and some of these songs are 1962. I mean, they do Twist and Shout, for example, that's 62, so it can't be a 1960 recording. So the subterfuge then to get around the business of EMI really owning this, even though they didn't make the tape, was to claim it was recorded earlier, but Ringo just happens to be on it.
Right.
Because in those days, the history of the Beatles wasn't as clear cut as we now have it. And people didn't know when they had been there, really. So it seemed plausible. And though, I mean, Alan Williams and Ted Kingsize Taylor had tried to get Apple to come in on the release of this tape in the early 70s, and in the end Apple didn't want to do it. And then in 77, when Alan Williams, Ted Kingsize Taylor and a guy called Paul Murphy tried to get this out, they tried to stop them, and it became a court case, and I remember it being the only court case in which I hoped that the Beatles lost, because I wanted to hear this tape, and I didn't want it to be blocked. I was desperate for it to be released. And it came out at almost the same time as the Hollywood Bowl album. So weirdly, we'd had no live albums at all of the Beatles. And suddenly, in the space of a few weeks, we've got Hollywood Bowl and Hamburg in 1977. So the Beatles tried to stop it and failed. But 20 years later, in 1998, with the horse well bolted from the stable door by this point, but just to exercise their rights, they took the owners of the tape to court again in the High Court in London in 1998 and won. And George Harrison went to the High Court in the Strand and gave evidence in the witness box. And I was there in the court.
Really?
And I was actually part of Apple's team for this. I also gave evidence in court in the box that day.
Wow.
Same day as George. In order to show that this thing had no basis of authorization, and that although it had been released and everyone who wanted to buy it had now bought it, technically it was an unofficial recording, and no one else should be making money on it other than the Beatles. And they won that case that time. And George, I'd like to think my evidence helped, but I think it was whenever a Beatle gets up in the witness stand in court, they're going to win. Because, the, as Alan Klein once noted, judges get Beatlemania. Yeah, George was there, and it was great to hear George on the witness stand talking about Hamburg.
Really?
Yeah, I was making notes I was in the gallery making notes.
Can you tell us any more?
Yeah, in fact, in the end, I bought. I was aware of the fact that court cases have transcripts, and if you apply immediately after a case is closed, you can get the transcript. So I paid for the transcript of the entire 3 or 4 days that we were in court.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was there every day, and as was Neil. Neil Aspinall was there, and it was, I think, the last time I was ever in George's company. And it wasn't entirely a happy experience either.
No.
But nonetheless, and Horse Fasher was there as well in court. Yep. And Bill Harry was there. It was really interesting.
Yeah.
King Size Taylor was there.
Wow.
And the only guy who was missing was this guy called Paul Murphy, who was the man in the shadows who was behind the whole thing from the 70s to the 90s. And I think has now died.
Oh. Because I know Alan Williams offered the tapes to Apple for £100,000, and they turned him down.
Yeah.
Then he went to Ringo and George, and they for £5,000, and they said no.
Their problem, I think, the Beatles always have a problem with anyone making money off them that should be rightly theirs. So that was an issue for them. Not only did they not want it out in terms of its content because it's, you know, lo-fi and a bit rough. But also because why should anybody else, you know, reap whatever reward comes from this when it's really being sold on the basis of our name? That's a common theme amongst artists, and the Beatles have felt that way about people since 1963. That's never changed, and you can understand it. So that was an issue. In the very first instance, King Size Taylor offered it to Brian Epstein. And although he says it was 1967, it was actually 1963 that he offered it to Brian Epstein. Quite what Brian could have done with it then, I do not know. But so he made Taylor an offer of £20,
really?
Just for his time and trouble in making the tape and offering it to them. And King Size kind of sniffs and snorts at that, as you know, as if it was ludicrous. But it was a fair offer at the time, I would say, because it wouldn't have been releasable then. There was no possible sense, even though Brian, almost uniquely in the world, knew how big the Beatles were going to be, there would have appeared in 1963 to be no commercial value to a lo-fi record, a spool of tape, with a lo-fi recording of them when they're already under contract to EMI. So he made Taylor a token offer of £20, and Taylor turned him down. And as that clip on YouTube will tell you, fantastically, it ended up in a derelict building in a little back street in Liverpool called Hackins Hay. Hay spelled H-E-Y, which is still there to this day.
Is it?
Every time I go to Liverpool, I always go to Hackins Hay. Yeah.
Wow, because I thought he said on the tape that it was going to be knocked down.
That side of the street was knocked down, or at least part of it was, not all of it. There's still a pub, there's still an old pub on Hackins Hay on that side of the street, which I go in when I'm there. But the other side of Hackins Hay is still there complete.
Wow.
And it didn't get knocked down, and it is still there. But the building where this tape was did get demolished. and they broke into it, or at least got access to it. I think a night watchman of some kind let them into a derelict building. He had the key, and they went and sorted through the rubble. And it sounds like a fairy tale, but it's absolutely true. This tape was literally kind of lying in the dust. Somebody says it was on the... Kingsize Taylor says it was in the basement. Alan Williams says it was on the top floor. Who knows? But there had been a studio there run by a guy called John Seddon. And that's how the tape had ended up in Hacking's Hay. And Seddon had gone out of business and not removed things when he left. And the tape was there in the rubble. And from that point on, Williams and Taylor knew that if they played their cards right, they could make some money out of this. The Beatles industry was in its infancy then, post-Beatles, because remember, after the Beatles broke up, there was a decline in interest in them, particularly in Britain. So they hoped to make a lot of money on it, but they weren't quite sure. Alan Williams was talking telephone numbers, but
he was.
It could have been anything, really, anything. Because there wasn't the industry that we now have for anything Beatles. But eventually it took another 4 years to come out, and the Beatles tried to stop them and failed. So it did come out, but it came out on spurious record labels.
Yeah, it's all over the place if you look.
Yeah, a man who eventually became a friend of mine, Chris White, wrote the sleeve note for the original release. And the American issue of the Star Club album had four tracks different from the European release, so I had to buy the import as well. So very quickly I had it twice. And then there were more tracks, and then more tracks, and then more tracks, and eventually, by the early 80s, I was writing the sleeve notes for it. The first sleeve notes I ever wrote were for the Hamburg tapes. A release on a little record label called Breakaway Records.
Okay.
In about 1983-84. So I have my own history with this album as well. And the titles were never right on the original albums.
I remember every version I had, they'd be slightly different. Yeah. Retitled Little Queenie or whatever it was, and Shimmy Shimmy.
Yeah, I wish I could shimmy like my sister Kate was written as Shimmy Shimmy, which was actually a different song.
Yeah.
You can understand why somebody thought it was Shimmy Shimmy. Yes, and that was how I ended up getting the job to write the sleeve notes in 83, because there was some dodgy release on, well, not dodgy, it was a proper record label. All these releases of the Hamburg tapes in those days were bona fide record companies, in that they paid their PRS or their MCPS, or in America, ASCAP or BMI or whatever. The rights and mechanicals were paid, but really they were kind of little fly-by-night labels. And one of them, one release of this album had so many track titles wrong, and therefore composers wrong, and therefore publishing companies wrong, and therefore the wrong money, or money was going to the wrong writers when it should have been other people, that I criticised it in an article in Beatles Monthly. And the owner of the record label said, well, why don't you write the sleeve notes then and tell us what the titles really are? And I did. almost 40 years ago now.
Wow.
Frightening. Two versions of I Saw Her Standing There, and it's much like they would do it, what is it, 6 weeks later at EMI for the first album. And yet we have a recording of them doing that in December 62, where they do it much more bluesy, because I think they're trying to attract the interest of a bluesy cover version at that time. But here they do it much as they would do it at EMI, except that, as someone once pointed out to me, George never did the same guitar solo in I Saw Her Standing There twice.
No.
Every version of it has a slightly different solo, and the two versions of it on this album have different solos from each other. But you also get to hear a lot of George's bum notes on this album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't deny that there's a lot of them, as there would be on the as there had been on the Decca tapes and as there would be on the BBC sessions.
Oh, big time, yeah.
Yeah.
I think George never played, I might have got this wrong, Long Tall Sally, after the da 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 da. Every time after that,
yeah,
to me, they all sound different.
Yeah.
It just riffs.
Yes.
Which I quite like.
Yeah. No, I mean, not knocking George as a guitarist, but your ears tell you, you know, they don't lie. You know, there are some bum notes here. But, you know, they're in a club.
Yeah.
And they're playing to people who are standing there talking and drinking and dancing and going off to the toilet and smoking and whatever they're doing. They're not just, it's not a gig.
No.
It's a club.
And not expecting all those years later for two blokes to be talking about their guitar solos.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I guess. Exactly that. Yeah. But nonetheless, the speed with which they play this set, the energy that's in it. I love the placement of the microphone just happens to pick up John's guitar more prominently than you normally hear it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it isn't, unless you're really tuning in and focusing on it, you can't always make out John's rhythm guitar on the EMI tracks. Yes, you can hear it. I'm not saying it's not there, but it's not. It doesn't leap out at you in the way that it leaps out of these Star Club tapes, purely because the microphone was probably nearer his amp than it was nearer the other amps.
Yeah.
So you get to hear John as a rhythm guitarist, and it's great. Mm. It's just absolutely great, the way he drives these songs forward.
Yeah.
And all these little moments that make this album so special. You wouldn't necessarily put it on at a party and, you know, and say, you know, I love the Beatles, listen to the Star Club album. But it is a historically vital recording.
Mm.
And, you know, they come back to England on New Year's Day 63, just having played the Star Club. And Please Please Me is issued on the 11th. 6 weeks later, it's number one. And they're away. They also know that they're not going back to Hamburg anyway, even if they don't have a number one. They're not coming back. Ultimately, they go back in 66 and play a gig, but they're not going to do any more of these clubs. They've had enough of it. You know, it's their fifth time, and the hallmark of the Beatles is they don't like repeating themselves. So they don't want to come back anymore. Even if they're not famous, they don't want to come back. They've done it. They've been there, and they've done it. And at the end of the fifth trip, they've done about 1,100 hours on stage in Hamburg.
Wow.
And what we hear on this album is kind of the last two or three hours of the 1,100.
Yeah.
And it's a great pity we don't have them in the Indra and the Kaiserkeller in the top 10, but we do have them in the Star Club. And the thing about the Star Club is that it became the Hamburg club. And it's the one that everybody talks about. But in the Beatles' own history, it's the least important of the three clubs they played there. The Indra and the Kaiserkeller and the top 10, the four clubs they played there, sorry. The other three, the Indra, the Kaiserkeller and the top 10, are much more important to them than the Star Club. Because by the Star Club, they kind of got it all together. But their real steep learning curve happens in the other clubs.
Mark Lewisohn, thank you very much for your time.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on. Hey!